Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode 366 of the podcast. And it's Wednesday, 28th of February, 2018, as I record this early. As I record this, I'm heading off to Italy, to the Amalfi Coast for some walking. I will be back as this show goes out, but I won't have time to record. So you'll have to wait until next week to hear all about my trip away. So today I'm talking about how to write high volume fiction in a sustainable way with Toby Neal. Now, Toby is fantastic and I love talking to her. She's very wise. And this interview helped me reset my sails and figure out my direction. So I hope you find it useful, whatever your stage in the journey and however you choose to write. Because we also talk about sustainability, the healthy writer, marketing tips, and how to retailer proof your author business by selling direct for the long term. So this is definitely not all about KDP Select. In fact, completely the opposite. Okay, so I did want to talk a bit about futurist stuff, as I had too many articles that I wanted to share last week, so I'm going to share them now. Following on from the Amazon Polly AI voice tech I talked about a few weeks ago, a few more updates on the rise and rise of voice. So Chinese AI titan Baidu announced its deep voice AI had learned some new tricks on the next web. It unveiled its AI is capable of cloning a human voice. It can clone the voice with just a few seconds of audio. Now, first of all, that's a little bit scary because it means you could take my podcast and you could do whatever you want with my voice. But of course, if you combine that with something like Amazon Polly, which will turn text to speech with an AI that sounds more human, I'm hoping that this will mean I can have an AI read my audiobooks in my voice, but without, of course, I could go to a studio and record it myself, but I did that for Business for Authors and it was so tiring. So I would love to be able to have something like this in my voice, that you would go onto the blog and you'd be able to get my books in my voice, even like with fiction. I would love my fiction to be read in my voice. So I think that's really, really interesting. Also, the next web reports that by 2020, 30% of search will be voice conducted using audio-centric technologies such as Apple's AirPods, Google Home, and Amazon Echo. And according to Global Web Index, 25% of 16 to 24-year-olds use voice search on mobile. And I think this is really interesting because we have both the Amazon Echo and the Google Home. Jonathan wanted to try them both, and they're really not very expensive. So we got them both and they are definitely good at different things. So that's quite interesting. I'm listening to a lot more music. I'm not really a music listener, but I listen to a lot more music through the Echo now. So that's very interesting. And we do use the voice search rather than the phone for short queries with an obvious answer, like, is it going to rain today, before going out? Wired.com takes this into the realm of commerce, looking at how voice technology is affecting business. They report that in the US, more people now listen to podcasts each month than use Twitter regularly. So that is really interesting. And they talk about how that is changing advertising revenue and say, eventually, podcasting is going to do to radio what cable TV did to network TV and what Netflix is now doing to cable TV. It will be the showcase for the premier storytelling in that medium. Also, publishers are reporting declining ebook sales, but growing audiobook revenues, with audio filling the digital revenue gap that ebooks left. And I can tell you, I'm listening to so many more audiobooks. In fact, I have one credit on Audible every month, but I just went and bought a load more audiobooks to take on holiday because I just really find it very relaxing. And I enjoy listening, particularly to nonfiction with audio. Also, it says using a keyboard and mouse to manipulate a computer after successfully using voice feels about the same as using a command line interface on an old Unix machine after using a graphical interface. It's starting to feel a little barbaric and has a certain never going back to that crap quality to it, which is really interesting. And says Amazon Echo sales have shattered all analyst estimates. Apple is rushing to catch up with its HomePod. And Facebook just announced its own smart speakers. So very interesting how voice technology might potentially change business. And then finally, in something that makes me quite happy in terms of Google search, because Google owns YouTube, The Verge reports that YouTube live streams will soon include automatic captioning. So at the moment, if you are a YouTuber, as I am, not a very serious one, but I am doing a lot more on YouTube these days, you can upload a caption file and, you know, or you can use the auto captioning and then fix it, which you can also do on Facebook, which is quite interesting. But this says that YouTube live streams will soon include automatic captions utilizing live automatic speech recognition LASR technology, which is approaching industry standards for error rates and latency, which means as in people typing in the background. So this is really interesting for me as well, because I pay for transcription for the podcast and this will keep indexing in words. So I imagine that what's happening here is Google will end up using this type of automatic speech recognition technology to drive voice search on the internet through these voice devices. So there are some people saying that you should be using snippets and trying to, which is another plugin or whatever, in the back end of your website to try and catch these voice searches. But I'm hoping that this type of speech recognition technology will enable those of us who do voice things to still find internet and, you know, websites and books and text-based stuff. So all in all, just wanted to wrap up a few things that I think are interesting around voice tech. And again, I'm certainly trying to get more of my nonfiction books into audio and have seen my audio revenues go up since really focusing in on nonfiction rather than fiction. So my personal update is I am away, so I have no personal update and no tweets and emails because I'm away and haven't been picking them up. I'll be doing an extended introduction next week. So today's show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and I'll play a word from them in a minute. And of course, thanks to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. And if you've started supporting the show on Patreon in the last 10 days, I will be reading your name out next week. I'll also be recording the next Patreon supporters only Q&A. So please get your questions in for March. And I really do appreciate the Patreon support, like the tweets and emails that I normally read out. It demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And if you'd like to support the show, you'll get several years of extra monthly Q&A audio, and you know you want all that extra audio because everyone's listening to more audio after all. So you can get that if you start supporting the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, here's a word from our sponsor and then we'll get on with the interview.
Hey, I'm Christine Monroe, the Senior Manager of Kobo Writing Life, Kobo's free and easy self-publishing platform that helps authors like you reach millions of dedicated Kobo readers around the world. We're looking for new stories to feature on our blog and podcast, and we want to hear from you. Do you have an interesting pricing or marketing strategy that's working really well right now? Are you dedicated to publishing widely to all retailers? And how has that helped you grow your global fan base? Email us right now at writinglife@kobo.com with your ideas and some background information about you and your books, and you might get featured alongside huge indie bestsellers and industry experts. We cannot wait to hear from you. Back to you, Joanna.
Today, I'm here with Toby Neal. Hi, Toby.
Hi, Joanna. I love to see your smiling face.
It is a smiley show today, for sure. Just a little introduction. Toby is an award-winning USA Today best-selling author of mysteries, thrillers, and romance with over 30 titles out. She's also a mental health therapist, a career that has informed the depth and complexity of the characters in her stories. And we did a previous podcast all about characters and place, and that was just really fascinating. But today we're talking about the tips and strategies of high production, high earning indie authors. So basically those authors earning over six figures, some multi six figures, some seven figures. So this is a fascinating topic. So let's start out. Explain, what is the high production business model? How does it work practically for indies?
Well, I can't speak for everyone, but I know for me, the goal of every book is to have a live purchase link for the next book in the back. Mm. So this is what makes it high production, is that you're on a 3-month publishing schedule. You're on a deadline at every book. And so, and I actually last year did 10 books.
Oh, my goodness.
10 books. Six of them were co-authored. I went ventured into that territory and did a really fun, it was a blast to write, I have to say, pandemic romance series.
Dystopian
pandemic romance with my friend Emily Kimmelman. And we did six books in the series. And I will say we were inspired by your podcast and the sort of the trending that you were talking about of co-authoring. Mm. And we both thought we could increase our production speed by working together, which actually, it turned out to be a little bit not the case. So I am diverging,
but it does
have to do with it. If you're thinking of co-authoring as a way to increase your production speed, don't count on it right away, because that first couple of months working out the bugs of how to do it with each other and still create a quality product was, by far as much work as writing my own books or more.
Mm, and you have to split the money. That's important.
And then we split the money. Right. Mm. And in our case, we went in a completely new genre, which wasn't probably the smartest business choice. So, so again, kind of focusing back on our topic, if you're going to produce a lot of books, they should be in a high selling genre in a series. So that's kind of a given that I always assume people know, but, there's so many great tools out for you to help find a niche to exploit, if you will, if you're looking for like a business way to write, like Kalytics. Those reports have been very good. If you had him on the show to interview.
I haven't, but I promote Kalytics. So yeah, fantastic.
I think that they're terrific. I mean, who knew cowboy romance was the thing or whatever. So if you're looking for like how to make money writing books, there's so much great information out there now that there wasn't when I got started or you got started. We're all just sort of fumbling in the dark. But what I did discover was that I was a prolific writer. And once I got going, I was generally turning out on a bad year, 4 books a year. That was a bad year. And I write in mystery police procedural, which is a little bit slower genre and compared to some. I know romance writers who are regularly turning out a book a month, and that's sort of the speed for a high production romance writer is breakneck.
Indeed. Well, just before you go on there, so let's just on a series, because I'm interested, so there are a few ideas around series, which is you write, mm-hmm. say 3 books before you publish, or you write 3 and have another 2 ready. And so you can go bang, 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 because mm-hmm. it's all very well saying you should write a series, which I agree with, but you can't put 1 book out and expect anything to happen. So how many books in a series before things start to get traction, do you think? Or is it literally you can start with book 1, but you have to have 1, 2, 3 ready to go?
Okay. So this kind of harks back to my, this last year's co-authoring experiment. We wrote 4 of the books completely before we began releasing. And then we released them once a month, thinking we would really get momentum. It actually turns out that I think that's too fast if you're not established in a genre. So if you're beginning, every 3 months time frame is a really good way to do it. Mm-hmm. If you're not confident, you can build up your backlist to have that many, you know, you should definitely hold on to your books until you have 3. But I actually don't really, I have 2 main selling series, the LA Crime series with 12 books, which is complete at this point. And I have a Kindle World with that and all of that. And then I'm doing a spin-off series with a side character that's a little bit more action-adventure-y, that's called the Paradise Crime series. And I didn't start, even though I had totally set the stage for that second series to just pick up where the other one left off, you always lose readers who are loyal to a certain character for whatever reason. You cannot count on bringing them into your next series. You kind of have to, I think that that's a critical point for many readers. And and as a reader myself, I'm like, well, I love Patricia Cornwell, but I don't like her Lucy series. I only like her, but you know, we are how we are, right?
Yeah, so, definitely. Okay, so
I'll say 5 books is actually the new standard to really give something a chance. And that is, that's tricky because if you're going down a road that's not going to go anywhere, you've already put a lot of resources and time into it. And so that's tough.
Yeah, I agree. And in fact, I'd go so far to say 6 books because box sets are so often 3 books. Yeah. And I know my editor is also a writer, Jen Blood. She has a Pentalogy, a 5-book series. And it's a nightmare because, of course, you can't 5 books in a box set is very hard because you can't really price it and you can't put 3 in one and 2 in another. Yeah. So I would say like 3, give it a chance, and then or 6. And I'm at 9 with the Arcane series. Mm-hmm. But I know I'm diverging, but I have so many things to ask you. The spin-off series is interesting because so I'm at 9 with my Arcane series and I want to do the United States of Arcane, so I want to do like US of A, and I want to do I need to do at least 3 books in that kind of spin-off series with you know, a different character. And then when like I'm thinking the same thing, but is it that we want to do that because we need another a second entry point? You know, I'm really thinking, so what if people don't want to start a book 1 from the original series, but we want them to start again? So are you expecting people to find your new series and then maybe go back and read the old one? Or are you expecting to kind of carry on? Like, I guess, why did you do it? Why did you stop at 12? Because you could just keep writing the same one.
Oh, gosh. You know, again, the things you learn in this business. So I sort of painted myself into a corner in the 12 book series by having my characters age. Oh. And I had a 5-year gap in there where I wanted the Kindle world to have room to play without the major plot thread. So I made a big 5-year gap in the canon books. They call them the canon books. And all of a sudden I was like, oh my gosh, they're having a kid. I want them to, you know, like I wanted certain things to happen, and then the juice was just no longer there. And unless I was going to have a major tragedy, like I could totally keep it going if I kill X. And I polled my readers and they were like, we won't ever read you again if you do that. So you can't betray your readers. You have to give them what they're there for. And so in a way what I think I could do is go back in time and write out of that gap that I made, you know, but I felt like I learned something from that. And I was going to now have my new series is always present now. Right. There's no time passing. It's just continuously happening in now. And I've avoided some of the potholes I accidentally came upon in terms of like time passage and things like that.
Yeah,
I also had
a
certain character arc. I think I talked about that in our other talk. I had certain issues and character arc that I wanted to explore with that character. And I completed that arc. And it just no longer had, I don't know.
Yeah.
I had a perfect ending. I can't mess it up.
Yeah, I know.
Even for money.
I know what you mean. And it's hard to balance the creative drive as well to do something different with serving the readers. And the high production, high earning model is also that high earning is what does make some money. Mm-hmm. But let's just, I want to also circle back on quality because you mentioned quality. And I know it is one of the biggest issues that people have with the idea of a high production model. Mm-hmm. Some people will say, how can a book written in a month or even 3 months be quality? So how are you balancing that? How are you seeing that amongst your high production friends?
Yeah, I think everybody kind of has a system worked out by now. So people who are in it to this level have a team. They have a team of copy editor, you know, proofreaders. They have fact checkers. They have assistants. They have, I don't know about you, but I have kind of a village of people working. And I love that. I love that I get to stimulate the economy and all these home businesses, you know, all these different kinds of folks working in their, you know, for the most part in a developing, fascinating new subculture of work that's happening. So there's that. You don't skimp on those things. If you're starting out, there's a lot you can do with groups and sharing and cross-sharing, all of that. I think in our other talk, I explained how I use experts for authenticity in a fast moving way. So I literally will sit down with the expert I've picked. For instance, I'm writing a new romance called Somewhere in Wine Country, which is where I'm living right now, Wine Country. I know nothing about wine making, wine growing, wine anything. It's a whole new area. So
I have wine. It is late here. It's like your morning. It's my morning. Evening.
I've got green drink. But anyway, so I said, turns out my niece is a wine educator who works for a major winery. And so she's going to be my expert on this book. We sit down, I have an intensive interview with her for about 2 hours, taking copious notes. Then I sit down and I hammer out the book. Just like, I put some knowledge in there. Who knows if it's completely right. I'm just going. Then she gets the manuscript. And she goes through it for fact checking, you know, like already I know I was talking about, you know, the quality of the soil and she said something about that, but I have no idea. And so I'm just like, and it needed more calcium and blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, so she's going to fix the details of the book, you know, by doing that. And then we also have a back and forth on email. Like I'm truly stuck. A big question occurred to me. It's a setup romance where the guy has purchased the auction thing from the impoverished young heiress and you know, and they're stuck in the house together. And I'm like, wait a minute, the fields are completely fallow. The vines are just sitting there for months. What am I going to get this couple doing? Like, besides the obvious. And so I write her like, what do people do in the winter when the vines are resting, you know? So anyway, I know I'm off topic, but this way of using an expert where you're really putting about, you've got your interview, you've got them reading the book, you've got the corrections for that. Very little time in research, considering what you could spend if I was traveling around here wine tasting every weekend doing quote research.
See, that's what I do. I do the research because that's the bit I enjoy.
Of course, I love it too, but it's like, it's a time waster. You could spend 6 months doing that. And, you know, in this production model, you're cutting all the time that you possibly can because you're on these deadlines. And there really is an incredible advantage to having your book come out and having that live pre-sale link in the back to all the people you pre-sold the book to before. And you're basically training them, read, buy. And you're going to have your fix every 3 months or so. Yeah. All the other stuff, the marketing and all of that is important and necessary. And I think anybody who's doing well, maybe I'm going out on a limb to say this, but anybody who's doing well in this market, it's a tough market, is advertising. And that is as well as all these other things we're talking about.
Mm.
But that's a dark beast for me.
Yeah. Well, we'll come back to that too. But I also just wanted one specific question on word count. So how long are mystery thriller is normally longer than romance, isn't it? So what sort of word count are we talking about?
Mine are between 70 and 80,000 words.
Yeah.
So they're not super long.
But yeah. That's full length. Yeah.
Yeah. And they do, I don't think I can do a good one in less than 3 months. I just absolutely don't think I can because of the nature of the story. I think I could write romance faster if I only did that because it's sort of a flow and it's got a well-established trope. In terms of, you know, boy meets girl, blah, blah, blah. And then you go back and forth. And you can ad lib a lot more. In mystery, you really have to, you have twists, you have unexpected things, you have red herrings, you have all these, it's just more complex.
And then if you
want to challenge yourself and you write from different points of view and things like that, which I continue to like to do, I like to see, that's the thing. You know, we're creative people creating an art form and making a business out of it. And that's, it's going to burn you out if you don't have some liberty to make it wonderful, you know, and enriching for yourself.
Yeah. So let's, so wonderful and enriching and we're making money and we're creating things, but the concern, as I covered, you know, in the Healthy Writer and other things is the, and you have it right there, which is so cool.
I bought this as soon as it came out because health is so at the forefront of my mind. And it has been an issue for me and many of the other writers I know who are writing at this level, putting out this number of titles. Your health is going to be impacted by this if you're not making some modifications for the demand of sitting in the chair this long and using your hands like this, you know.
Yeah. So tell us about your experience with the health issues and some of the things you've had to change because of this model.
Well, first of all, I love your book. I think everybody should get it. Everybody who's a serious writer and is in it for the long term should read it or have it for reference because all the things that I think this talk started because I heard you were going to do this and I was like, Joanna, I'm so excited about all the health things I'm doing to keep writing at the level I'm writing. And do you need any more help? And you're like, I have bajillions of ideas from other people. So no, thank you. But so anyway, I can't say enough good things about it because many of the things I would have told you, you did, you had them all in here and you're with a doctor and everything. So it's great. But for me, I think the injuries fall into sort of two categories. One is back pain from sitting, overweight because again, inactive, headaches and eye problems, carpal tunnel. And I got carpal tunnel early on as I was racing down this highway, by doing NaNoWriMo on a laptop. Highly not recommended. And then once you have it, you always have it and you just have to manage it. And so, I don't know how it's going to sound. Maybe you could edit this out, but I think of myself as like an athlete. Okay. This way of making a living is like running an ultra marathon. You're not in a sprint. You're in a long race because I plan to write, I have a great big awesome goal of writing 100 books. I'm going to write 100 books and I also want to live to be 100, right? How am I going to live to be 100 and write 100 books sitting at my desk with curvature in my spine and little clawed hands, you know? So the biggest two things that I've done is yoga.
Yay.
So I have a daily yoga practice. I do like 10 sun salutations every morning when I first get up to just sort of limber everything up. Then the other major, major accommodation I have made is I got into voice dictation. Mm-hmm. So for all my new composing. So I'm a plotter. I kind of think that everybody writing mystery needs to be a plotter because it's plot heavy, you know, and also police procedural. There's always certain scenes you have to have, the morgue scene, the team scene at the police station. You know, there's things that you just, every book has. But I get my outline. I do outlines by hand. Everything's handwritten. And I think I tap into a different creative side of my brain for inventing and conceiving. And then I transfer that to, so every writer who's writing a ton of books has a different method. So this is just my method. I transfer that to Scrivener. I've tried, you know, been very happy with that until this last book when it wouldn't let my book out and I couldn't compile. It was horrendous. But I transferred to Scrivener or Word in an outline form. And then I do every day, I walk and dictate. And so I'm getting that movement. I'm keeping my weight managed. I'm keeping all those things that you talk about in your book that you've had to do, right?
And I'm not even a high production writer. I mean, I think we all have to do it.
You do this show. You do so much for writers. So, you have an insane pace. I can't imagine. But all that moving around is something we have to do. And the process, I don't use Dragon. I don't use that. I just use my voice to text feature on my iPhone. And it's pretty gobbledygook at times. It's hilarious. but it's into a Google Doc. Then I just, you know, copy that into my outline and massage the words. And then what I've noticed is that my productivity, whether I'm typing or whether I'm dictating, is still about the same. I think it's my creative brain is just like only capable of generating so much material. And I'm a writer. I'm turning out 4 or 5 books a year and I'm only getting in 2,500 or less fresh words a day. Hmm. So I am not, you shared about batching and I absolutely love that concept. But for me, I can't, slow and steady wins the race is what works for me, is a very, you know, regulated routine, you know, my exercise, my certain kind of diet. So I mentioned green drink. I stay away from carbs. Like, so I'm an athlete, right? I'm taking care of my brain and my body so I can do this work. That's how I think of it. And everything is about optimizing that. So, you know, I'm on an anti-inflammatory diet when I drink a lot, you know, vegetables, protein, anything that slugs me out or makes me foggy mentally has to go. You know, I've had to switch from coffee to tea because coffee just made me spike and tea was more, I got a little caffeine, but it's like, you know, so everything I'm always studying, how to optimize my own performance as far as coming to the page.
I love the idea of the optimizing the performance. And I think and it's interesting you do 2,500 words a day because, you know, you do hear like my friend Lindsay Barocca, you know, does like 10,000 a day.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. And she hikes like a crazy person and she has a, you know, dogs and, you know, so she looks after her body too. But it's really interesting that you have to do this. I'm wondering about the burnout of ideas, because I know some people like I wanted to write something different, you know, move to Map of Shadows, dark fantasy, because I was like, you know what? I'm a little bit burned out with action adventure. Like what else is there? So that burnout can happen on the creative level as well as the physical level. Romance, for example, you know, there are very set tropes that you have to hit. Otherwise those readers will go nuts. So do you think, or do any of your, you know, sort of pals in that area get burned out on that creative side, or is it really just the physical issues?
Definitely. I think we all struggle with that because we've got something like my first series with the 12 books where, oh man, I wish I could have kept writing those because the transition was really rough. And it's just now picking up to, as far as sales, It's about two thirds of what it used, you know, what I used to make on one of those first books. And that has been after a tremendous amount of work to build. So everyone in, I'm in several groups, but we all grumble about it because like, I want to try, I do heartfelt romance and I want to try rom-com, you know, this is even among the romance writers and the rom-com doesn't do anything as well as the other, you know, whatever. So there's, what I did is venture into romance. Romance, writing romance for me is creatively sort of a palate cleanser from, you know, dead bodies and solving crimes. It's feel good. You know, the worst part of the story is they have a spat, you know, nobody dies. So I find it's very mentally renewing for me to keep my romance writing going on the side. And I just, you know, I start to get a little burned out on my action adventure because I'm now, my new series is much more action adventure than the police procedure, pure police procedural I started with. But I go and I do a day on the romance book and it's like I kind of think of my brain as like a sponge and it's getting dry and this just sort of plumps it back up. You know, I got away from the dead bodies and all of that. And I was on this other thing and it renewed me. So even if my romances I never am known for that. It never makes a ton of money or anything. I'm doing that as a creative palate cleanser. And I think everybody who's writing seriously and a lot is going to need those passion projects. We have to have our passion projects and we have to give ourselves permission to quote fail, you know, with those passion projects, if you will, like they're not going to make the same money because readers are, they're creatures of habit, you know, and they go to a certain name for a certain experience. And if you're an indie author who's not writing under pen names, but you're trying like I am. I think I have five genres now and I'm going to give myself permission to keep doing it. You know, I do have to come back to those bread and butter things, but if I'm interested in something, by golly, I'm going to do it because that's what keeps my, that creative flow moving within me.
Yeah. And also I feel like, you know, at the end of the day, we're indie authors. We're not meant to be like, if you want to do that, go write for a traditional publisher who says you must write the same book again and again and again, because they're invested in that. So I think that's really important. So I did want to ask on the publishing side, on the KU versus wide thing, because so many of the authors I hear in the high production model are focused on KU and page reads, but I feel that has a lot of issues. What are you KU? Are you wide? What is the feeling amongst the more mature people in this in this space?
I think for the most part, those of us who are sort of seasoned vets are wide. We're wide at this point. There's still, I have our Scorch series, the dystopian romance is in KU because it's such a niche that I just don't even know that we could find those readers on the other platforms at this point. And it's a new series. So we have that in KU, but that's pretty much it. For me, a long time ago we talked, and I was in KU with my main series. It's still a place where I think that starting out and you want to build a little bit of visibility, it would be a good place. But for me, no, I'll never go back. It's too riddled with, I'll never go back as a, you know, with all my books or anything, because it's just too riddled with, I guess corruption is perhaps too strong a word, but I am concerned very much with the scammers and the things going on there and how that's bleeding the whole system. There's also another issue that, my friend Russell Blake, who's also high production, he talked about how KU trains readers to to assume that they should never have to pay for anything. Basically, that $9.99 is rolled into their invisible costs, and it has kind of like Spotify and other music things. It has depressed the value of writing by creating an artificial free market, you know. That thought is really, I think it's too late. The ship has sailed. It's happened. It was part of Amazon's grand master plan, and it's worked in that sense. And it's great for readers. Happy for them. They're getting value and so on. But I am trying to give other retailers a chance and really kind of give them the time and keep, putting it out there that, Kobo is doing great with my box sets, using BookBub ads and targeting Kobo with box sets is a, there's a tip for you. This is an ad set that's working. I know I'm diverging, but I want to give you a tip. Make a really graphic looking, like graphic as in simple, bright, discounted box set, and then use your BookBub targeting to target Kobo and in Canada, and you will just clean up. There's my 2 cents for the day.
Well, I think, and that's a great tip. And it's funny because I've talked about that before on the show, targeting Kobo in Canada. And it's funny because like when you talk about advertising, so many people are targeting KU readers in America that of course, if you have things wide, it's, you do have a much bigger market. Like I just put up some ads also for like, it was Amazon, but in Australia, like thinking about these other markets where you can still make good money is great. But just, I think, and thank you for sharing that, because so many people think the only way to do the high production, high earning model is KU, whereas like what you're saying is totally not. You can definitely do this wide. But let's come on to advertising. So, because you mentioned it was a bit of a dark place for you.
Dark place, very dark.
But you also mentioned that it has to be done. What are some of the advertising or other marketing things that you do for your books or that you have your team do?
Well, I would say, and many others have said, your strongest marketing tool is your email list. And so this last 2 years, I've been working hard to build a large, strong, robust, and responsive list. I would say I put most of my money that I've spent into, capturing readers through different production companies that are putting on targeted emails that will match my readership, and then working on really awesome automations, which I didn't even believe in a few years ago. And this is like, I hate all those things. They sent you all those emails. It's so annoying. and then anyway, some enough statistics and I was converted. And so I have a really nice series of automations. Every time I get a new clump of emails, I work them through a targeted special automation for them. I have a phenomenal assistant who is very tech savvy. And so if you're going to do this, you should find someone like that. And we have, the emails are, I just sent one today and they make you smile. Like I want my readers to open my email and be like, grin, like, yay, I got free stuff. It was an uplifting experience. It was fun, So I put a ton into my emails and I think that, that's connected with giveaways. So another, big, investment I've made is adding on pretty substantial monthly box giveaways that include all kinds of fun swag. So I've got a signed book. I've got macadamia nuts. I've got a stuffed animal from one of the characters in the book. I've got, book barks. I even made a flash drive my character is a tech savvy, gal. So like this thing is probably costing at least $60 just cash out for me, not including my assistant and all the customizing and all the whatever. But what's great about it is she gathers all the swag, takes a photo. We put that on Facebook on my author page, do you want all this detail?
Yes, it's great.
Okay, put it on there. And then we get a tremendous, like even with Facebook's massive clampdown on visibility, I just boost that sucker, you know, get over it, spend the money, boost it. And then this is the genius part. Inside we say, winner will only be announced in my email newsletter. You want to sign up? Here's the link. In fact, but to enter, all you have to do is comment, because again, that's Facebook's rules. You shouldn't be sharing, no asking for likes. There's certain rules. So, but you can, they got to comment. And then we're announcing the winner in the email. So then I've got that going. I've got it boosted. I mentioned it in the email that blast. Hey, want to enter this month's thing? Here it is. It's awesome. Take me to the box, you know, and they click on it and they like it. And then my assistant gets them, if they liked it, if they participated, she gets them to like my page. So it's this incredible circle of juice, I should say, that's going out in all these directions and probably costing me $100 maybe, you know? So there's like the giveaways keep the readers engaged. So I basically have a giveaway each week that's smaller, and then a monthly big box. It's a lot to manage, but you know, that's what assistants are for. So
I find that really interesting. And I think the romance authors are very big on swag, right?
So yeah,
it's interesting you're doing it in mystery thriller. But I see why, because there's so much digital giveaways now. There's so many. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even like I just did one of the new Goodreads things. And I was doing when it was free, I was doing it with print books, and they would get like 1,000, 1,500 people entering. And I used their actual paid thing for the Kindle giveaway. Mm-hmm. And it was a third of the entries. Like people just have enough digital stuff.
So They're saturated.
So I really see that you do that. But of course, and I mean, we're talking about high production, high earnings. So people starting out, this is too expensive for people starting out. Yeah. And you didn't do that when you were starting out. This is like an upper level.
Further down the road. You've got your money train of books, and this is part of keeping the momentum going and keeping your readers opening your emails. You do need reasons for your readers to open your emails when you're starting out, you know, and you do need to, for me, it's been like, that's where my psychology background comes in handy, because I'm all about the behavioral training.
That's great. So give us a tip. Like, I could use help with opening, you know, people opening my emails. Like,
well, basically that there's something for free or something desirable for them in every single email. And that takes some thinking, you know, even on one where I'm like, hey, my new book is live. Here's the link. Finally, you don't want to clutter it up too much. I have one major call to action focus in each email, but also that they're going to have some sort of giveaway or freebie every time that, you know, so that they're training. Okay. So now the grand plan.
Yes.
I'm going to get excited. The grand plan is to move towards direct sales to my readers off my own website. Forget these retailers and all their ups and downs. Amazon and the 50% choice, like we're ever going to make that choice, whatever that choice is. So
we should just point out that at the time of speaking, the 50% is a rumor, and we don't know anything about it, but you know, it might happen. But so you are thinking of selling direct, print and ebook?
I'm a little daunted by print, but I'm heading in the direction of ebook direct marketing. Yes. And BookFunnel has been, I don't know how much we're supposed to mention all these brand names, but BookFunnel is one of the giveaway services.
Yeah,
and
no,
they have added sales onto their thing. Mm. And again, by the time this airs, I might have a lot more of this figured out, but I am moving ahead with some direct sale campaigns that are going to use BookFunnel and landing pages and just cut out the retailer entirely and see if I can train my readers from my email list. Again, you know, that's my main where I'm going to start to buy direct from me by, you know, giving them things that they can't get anywhere else, giving them discounts that are super attractive.
Which is interesting. And I think because so many, what annoys me so much is this obsession with ranking, you know, and in a way, yes, higher ranking means more sales. But what you're talking about is you would get the money train, as you mentioned, which I like. Mm-hmm. So you would get the 90-95% royalty, or let's say even 80-85% with some discounting that we would do. You would get that. There would be no ranking at all. Mm-hmm. But you would get more money. So what do you think about the obsession with ranking, and, you know, how does that play into the mindset of a, you know, someone like you who's just, you know, got a business model now?
That's interesting. It just really is about your priorities. So earlier on, I really wanted awards. I won awards. I really wanted to be on the bestseller list. I got on the bestseller list. Now I care about keeping money in my pocket and trying to provide for my retirement and, you know, and longer term goals that are more financially focused. So, and I see a lot of volatility in the retail, all the retailers and how they're doing things and how they're, you know, maneuvering. And I would like to retailer proof my business. So, while it may never, you know, while I may never be Potterville or whatever that's called.
Pottermore.
Yeah. I feel like everyone who's serious in this business needs to think about, you know, how can they reach their readers direct? And with someone like BookFunnel, and we've already training readers to download things for free through them in a different way and get them on their Kindle in a different way. Like, that's all training. That's all behavioral training. And why shouldn't we then capture that to the reader's benefit, who's already demonstrated loyalty to us, you know? So like I love BookBub. I'm a big BookBub fan, and I try to get a BookBub every month if I could. And they've been great to me too. I think I have close to 60,000 followers on BookBub.
Wow, that's amazing.
It is amazing. It is amazing. And I know it's because they pushed me. I don't know why, you know, like they, you know how they send those emails and they say, you would like to follow this, person.
Well, you must have been performing. They would only have pushed you if you were performing, if people were clicking and buying. So awesome. Well done, you.
I guess, but the truth is, those are not people I can control or reach except through their paid platform. And of course, I'm using that. I'm doing ads. I'm doing promos. I'm doing, you know, I'm using that. And I love BookBub. But I also know that BookBub could get sold to Amazon or whatever, or change their rules. And that those 60,000 followers, how am I going to reach them again? You know, or would I be able to afford to? And so again, where I think the high production, high earning, if you will, or maybe another way to put it would be very business-like author is going to be looking at how can we stabilize our revenue streams and create sustainable income? How can we always have our backlist working for us so we don't have to constantly hit that upcoming title, you know? And those are all questions and concerns that, you know, we put our heads together and brainstorm. And one of the best things that I've enjoyed is partnering with other people in the same genre to magnify my reach, you know? And so I know the romance writers do that a ton. It's a little trickier in mystery because, you know, there's fewer of us. And then something very similar is hard to find. But like in my partner, Emily Kimmelman, I sent her a text the other day. I think we have achieved interchangeability. And so even though we co-wrote this series in a completely other genre and it's not doing as well financially as we want, our action adventure women, you know, protagonists with a dog, you know, mystery solving series are wherever you see her, you see me, wherever you see me, you see her, you know, we're achieving that level of cross-pollination. And so finding a partner that you could do that with, it's like it magnifies everything that you do.
Yeah.
So that's another great strategy for anyone starting out or seasoned pro.
No, I love that. And you're so wise. I think you're very wise. I appreciate you coming on the show and talking about this stuff. I did want to ask you, because we're almost out of time. One of the issues I feel so often that I think I know what I want to do, and then I am blown off course when I hear people, often at conferences, or, and I'm, you know, like I might go to Thriller Fest, like, you know, I go to Thriller Fest and I'm surrounded by Lee Child and, you know, Douglas Preston and, you know, award-winning. And I'm like, oh my God, I just want a traditional publishing deal and win prizes. And then I go to a conference and I'm blown off course and I want to do like all in KU because that's the way to make money. And then I'm like, stop it, stop it. So how do you, and I think I'm mature half the time, I think I'm mature, but, and then I realize, oh my goodness, this must be happening to lots of people all the time. So how do you stay on course with what you really want? And also, how do you deal with comparisonitis in the community? Because you also network with very, very high earners. Inevitably, there will always be people who earn more and who earn less.
One of the most exciting things I did this year was write my personal mission and vision statement, and then my ideal day. So that is, again, my mental health background coming up. And I wrote it out in detail. I actually am doing business coaching with a professional woman who's helping me develop my corporation. So this last year I incorporated. I took a lot of big girl panty steps this last year. And things that needed to happen, every single stage has been scary. But I keep pressing forward because I do have a vision for my life and it's actually coming to pass. It's so much what I've always wanted. And now I just want to sort of build it or make it stronger or whatever. So I highly recommend that process to write your personal mission statement. Why is it that you do what you do? What is it about? Again, harking to my mental health background, one of the techniques I was really known for was that when I worked with clients, I would have them do affirmations, you know, their statements of their desired outcome. So it's important that they're always phrased positively. It's not, I want to lose weight. It was like, I want to feel great in my body. You know, see the difference between those two things. And I use hypnosis, basically, just a cadence of your voice and certain kinds of, cues as we do it. And I, do a recording of their affirmations and I have them listen to it every day. So I actually do this for myself, Joanna. I have very well written out, put some serious hours into it, worked with my coach to make sure it covered body, mind, will, emotions, my physical self, and all of those areas, and got a really comprehensive picture of how I sort of fit into the world as a person and a storyteller and a businesswoman, and all of those things. It's all encompassed in that. And then I recorded that. And then on my walk, before I start my dictation, I listen to it. So I'm constantly sort of reprogramming my mind to the things, the outcomes, the beliefs, and the knowledge that I want to have versus being swayed by every new and shiny, you know? So I feel very secure and grounded in who I am. I don't need to go to a lot of conferences. I just get confused and overwhelmed by those things. So I tend to stay away. What I'm doing now is I miss my counseling practice. So I've started a limited coaching, author coaching. And I work with those people either on the background stuff or on the marketing stuff or just getting their book done or whatever. And that's been super satisfying. Like there was a missing piece and doing my mission statement uncovered that is that in leaving my practice behind, I left a little piece of myself behind and I missed it. So I am doing some author coaching and, if people are interested in that, you know, I have a TobyNeilCounseling.com site and you can send me a email or whatever. But that's one of the main tools I use is affirmations and recordings to help stay the course.
Yeah, which is just fantastic. So I could talk to you forever, but we are out of time. So where can people find you and all your books online?
Oh, you can just Google me in any of the retailers, Toby Neal, or TobyNeal.net is my main author website. And then I have TobyNealCounseling.com. And I do, I'm also beginning some very small intimate retreats that we're going to do. I did my first one last year. It's just by invitation only by people who, you know, are in my sphere. But I bring in top end professionals, agent, lawyer, you know, different kinds of professionals. And then I do my recording hypnosis kind of fun, feel good stuff too. So those are all options that are available. And I'm excited to be growing in this part of my life and reclaiming it too. So yeah, there's a lot to do and not enough hours to do it, is there?
Oh, I know the feeling, but it's been so great to talk to you. So thank you for your time, Toby. That was great.
All right. Hope it was helpful. Take care.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Toby today. I certainly always enjoy speaking with her, so I hope you also did. Coming up next week, I have a special show for you. I'm talking to Dr. Karen Wyatt about writing on death, dying, and grief. And we have a really personal and fascinating chat. So whether you write fiction or nonfiction, these are topics that we all have to face we have to face them in our real life at some point. There's no escaping it. But although Karen and I do talk about trying to end death and the sort of death cancellation movement that's happening in Silicon Valley. So it should be interesting for you if you enjoy my books as J.F. Penn, or you're interested in death culture, or you are open to learning more about death, dying, and grief, and some of the issues perhaps that writers have when writing about it. I'll also tell you how my trip to the Amalfi Coast was. So look forward to an extended introduction next week. So have a wonderful writing week, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.